Here we go, recording in progress. And so we got a lot of really great questions. So I'm just going to jump right in and do my best. Some of these are quite long. And so I might have to do a little bit of editing just to get through them. Because when they hit the 1,000 word mark, that's a lot. Not to say don't do that, don't send them. I'm just saying I can't read the whole thing. But I'll try to summarize the salient points. I'm going to get to some of the shorter ones. Initially, and then we'll just bounce around. So this is from GRY. Is it Gry? I guess. I apologize if I'm not pronouncing it properly. Okay, I was wondering if there is a spiritual reason for why people like my friend experience heavy psychological effects after heart surgery. Super common. She had a valve replacement and she felt like she died and came back completely confused and depressed for many, many weeks, even months. She still has trouble with short-term memory 1 year after. Well, that could be due to a couple of things. So there's a whole lot here. And this again is where an integral approach, there's more to this question, but I want to stop and address a couple of things. This is where an integral approach to these things really comes into play. This could be purely a residue from the anesthetic. I mean, if you've ever had general anesthesia, depending on how long you're under, this stuff stays in your system, man. And that's why you don't want to do surgeries under general anesthesia unless you really have to, because it has a lot of less than ideal neurological consequences. And short-term memory loss is one of those. So is that connected to the heart thing? Maybe. I'll get back to that in a second. Could it be that the heart is disconnected, quote unquote, from the body and the brain, that the spiritual dimensions get confused about what kind of is like a death? No, spiritual dimensions don't get confused. We get confused. But at the same time, not since blood is pumping manually through the system. Okay. Yeah, this is actually kind of interesting. I've done a little bit of research on this a few years ago when I was exploring somatic memory. And it's really also it's all somewhat akin to this best-selling book, right? By Vanna Cook, Your Body Keeps the Score. Memory is lodged in the body, not just this 3-pound mushy thing that we have between our ears, right? That's just the transference mechanism from short-term to long-term hippocampus to neocortex, that kind of thing. But especially when you're working with your heart and all the neurites that are there, I mean, there's Candace Pert's really interesting work here. She's the psychoneuroimmunologist who is a big hitter in this world, NIH scientist who wrote this best-selling book called Emotion, Molecules of Emotion. And basically she says, this is the scientist, right? She says basically your body is your unconscious mind. And so we say memories are stored in the unconscious mind, memories are stored, they're stored in your body. And there's some really interesting literature about things like organ transplant cases, especially heart transplant. Now, this wasn't a heart transplant, but you start messing and playing around with the heart and doing valve stuff and whatever, you're dealing with some foundational things. You know, your consciousness is not just associated with your brain. You know, your GI system is called the second brain. Basically, Candace's work is that there are neural receptors, and check this out, there are neural receptors on every cell in the body. So you want to know where your mind is? Well, in this spatial temporal coordinate system, it's throughout your entire body. And so when they do things like, just to give you an extreme example, when they do things like organ donation, this is just mind-blowing. Not uncommon in this, especially with heart. Heart transplants have the biggest incidence of this. The patients who receive a new heart will actually start having memories that aren't theirs. They start having memories that are consistent with the donor. Hello? I mean, like, how bloody interesting is that, right? And so these are tricky to say, you know, especially in a soundbite online thing where I don't have tremendous health history, plus I'm not a cardiologist. It's hard to say exactly what's going on, but I can tell you for sure, both in combination with general anesthesia, especially when you start working with the heart, that it's not uncommon to have these kind of discombobulations take place. And I'd be very curious if people here have had these kind of surgeries, if you want to ping similar types of experiences, like, yeah, whoa, something very similar happened to me. Do that in the chat column. That's a really a nice thing to share. But for me to say, you know, could it be that the heart is disconnected from the body and the brain and spirit? I don't know. I can't tell you for sure. And it's really, really, really hard to say with any authority. I can only tell you it's not uncommon. And especially when you're working with heart, right? I mean, in the Tibetan tradition, again, another dimension. Now you're talking about inner subtle body yoga stuff. Your mind, you go to Tibet or Nepal, and it still blows me away because I see it all the time. When Buddhists talk about mind, they never point here, never. It still blows me away. They go mind, and they always point in their heart. And so the bindu, the heart chakra, that's where mind fundamentally resides. That is the essence of the mind in an inner yogic point of view. This is where you go when you die. This is where you go in deep dreamless sleep. This is where you go in deep meditation. And so in addition to what I just said about the so-called physical aspects, then you have the whole subtle and very subtle body aspects. So the heart is a really big deal, both in the physical world, obviously, and it's equally as important in the subtle inner yogic tradition. So in short, not at all uncommon to say what's actually happening. Ooh, that's really hard. I can't tell you for sure. Okay. All right, from Mary. I wonder if you can describe some examples of realizations in meditation. Okay, I can do that. I've been practicing Vajrayana / Tantra for several years now and would love to have an idea if some of my experiences during practice or meditation experiences or might be realizations. Okay. All that my teachers will say about realization is you'll know it when it happens. That's not very helpful. And yet I'm not sure. For example, when meditating on bliss, I can feel a profound bliss and peace. Good for you. But never the bliss of orgasm. Yeah, don't worry about that. When they talk about the big cosmic bliss, the great bliss, they're not talking about some endless orgasm, right? I mean, that's just like the closest thing that the human condition can get to bliss. That's small bliss. Great bliss is basically finding the bliss emptiness in any circumstance. Basically, it doesn't matter. That's great bliss. But never the bliss of orgasm, which some teachings indicate is a feeling of the state of true bliss. No, I wouldn't agree with that. No, that's provisional bliss. True bliss is the great equanimity. True bliss is the great bliss. That's basically finding, when we talk about bliss in this regard, this has a very technical definition in the Buddhist tradition, at least. True bliss here is the bliss of de-reification. True bliss is realizing the empty nature of whatever arises. That's real bliss. So when they talk about like the land of bliss, the pure land of great bliss, Dewachen, that's what it refers to. That this is talking about a dimension of reality that is suffused with the recognition of emptiness. So don't get too, you know, if you have a profound classic, what's called nyam, and I'll describe that in a second, bliss, clarity, and non-thought, that's fine, but don't get hung up on that and don't try to reinstate it. That's like the worst thing you can do. So I'll come back to that because this has to do with the difference between meditation and experiences and realization. So last thing here, and when meditating on clear light, it is never blinding, but clear and gray toned. Well, again, clear light, this is the clear light. When you talk about, again, clear light is another one of these really deep topics, concepts. You can have a clear light experience that is devoid of display. And by that, what I mean is it's a formless experience of the clear light. This is what people usually think is the clear light, the Dharmakaya, the clear light mind. No, that's just a clear light mind manifesting with the least amount of display. This is the clear light mind. You're looking at your computer. That's frozen clear light. You're looking at your wall. You're looking at your thoughts. You're looking at anything that arises. That's the clear light. It's just frozen. So when you're talking about meditating on clear light, to me, it sounds like you're meditating on formless meditations. That's great. I'm not criticizing it. But that's just clear light when the volume has been turned down. It's never blinding. Yeah, it's not blinding because it's not light in the provisional sense, but clear and gray toned. It can be any tone. It can be clear. I mean, clear light basically means clear refers to emptiness. Light refers to luminosity. That's all there is. Clear light means the union of luminosity and emptiness, and that means everything. So when you're talking about these particular meditations, my suspicion is you're talking about meditations that are guiding you to a clear light experience that is devoid of the excessive, what do you say excessive, the high volume display of the clear light. And so therefore, the most important thing here is there's nothing but the clear light. This is the clear light. Don't look for some big flashlight. Don't look for some big luminous thing, even though that may happen. That's a nyam. That's a meditation experience. So the first part of your question is really worth talking about a little bit. Experiences and realizations are not the same thing. And this is a big deal topic. I've written extensively on this. Meditation experiences are called nyam in Tibetan. By definition, they're always temporary. Always, by definition. An experience, by definition, always has a beginning and an end. By definition, nyam, like morning mist. Realization is totally different. Well, not totally different, but different. Tokpa in Tibetan. It's stable like a mountain. And so basically, there's a pretty big difference between experience and realization. So if you want to know if you're having a realization, that means it's stable. If you want to know if you're having an experience, that means it comes on and it disappears. So there's no doubt you're having experiences. I don't doubt that at all. But if they're coming and they're going, by definition, that's not a realization. That's an experience. And that may seem like, oh, this is just legalese or pedantic speak. No, it's not. Because what happens otherwise is you can have a meditation experience, confuse it for a realization, then you're really screwed. Because then you think you're having a true realization experience. You're like some mini Buddha, and you just had a high-level nyam. And this happens all the time. So this is where people really get stuck. When people think their experiences are realizations, that's a really big problem. So yeah, I'm not sure what else to say, Mary, if you want to come back on. Experience, again, this is so important. Experience, by definition, in the Buddhist tradition, always has a beginning and an end. It's temporary. That doesn't mean it isn't valid. That doesn't mean it isn't great. But this is what actually constitutes the journey through the fourth path, the path of familiarity, which is four stages on one path, is basically transforming, how did Houston Smith put it, transforming flashes of illumination, those are experiences, into abiding light, that's realization. That's what constitutes the 10 bhumis or the 10 grounds of progress. Your experiences become more and more stable, they mature into realization. But guess what? How do you do that? By letting go of the experiences. you don't stabilize the experience by grasping onto it. That's the last thing to do. You want to reinstate the conditions that brought about the experience in the first place, which is a quality of openness and release. So this is where these things get problematic, because you have some genuine opening. All experiences are based on opening. Realizations are stabilized opening. You have it and you think, because ego immediately appropriates it, you think you're a Buddha. Well, you are a Buddha on one level, but how does this thing go? Spiritual experience does not make a spiritual person. So what happens with these spiritual experiences, they're so delicious. They're like candy. It's okay to nibble on them, but if you feast on these things, they're going to make your meditation really sick, and you're going to get big-ass cavities. Sorry, I'm a retired dentist. You're going to get big cavities in your spiritual path. So have the experience, and then, like my teacher Kempo Rinpoche said, what did he say? You nurture your experience by destroying it. Let me say that again. You nurture your experience by destroying it. What that means is you destroy your grasping, clinging relationship to it. The experience itself is fine, but trying to grasp after it, trying to have it again, that doesn't mean we can't aspire. That doesn't mean we can, you know, have this aspiration. But you start grasping after these things, you just replace a chain made of lead with one made of gold. These are golden, they're called a golden cage in Islam. You get really stuck here. Thaisichu Rinpoche said these are the most serious of all traps, getting stuck in a meditation experience. And I can name, I won't do it, because I try to be polite. I could name at this point 20 so-called Western masters who claim to be realized, and they're simply just stuck in a nyam, guaranteed. So the classic noms, there's dozens of them. B. Allen Wallace writes about this beautifully in his book. I think it's called Calming the Mind, I think. Dujin Rinpoche's teachings on what? I can't remember the subtitle. But Allen writes about it a lot. I riff on it quite a bit because it's such a big deal. The classic experiences are bliss, clarity, non-thought. Each one is associated parenthetically with one of the trikayas, one of the kayas. But then you have countless other experiences. I mean, there's an infinite variety. They're all fine if you relate to them properly. If you don't, they can become a real problem. Good question. From Carol, persistent obstacle to the development of dream yogas. A question regarding dental device for sleep apnea. Yes, I can talk about that. After a sleep study a year ago for sleep apnea, for the past year, I have struggled to experience undisrupted sleep using the ResMed. Yep. And the full phase CPAP. Yep. You're not the only one. In your experience with my practice, does the mandibular advancement dental mouth device offer a viable option? Absolutely, positively, 1,000%. And so this is a really interesting thing because a lot is shocking. I have to tell you, it's shocking. How many GPs, doctors, either they don't know about the studies and the efficacy of these mandibular advancement devices, or they just don't want to get rid of their appropriating tendencies, they're saying everybody has to be on a CPAP. No way. Everything depends on your AHI, your apnea hypopnea index. This is a great question to bring, by the way, to our sleep doc once a month, second Tuesday of every month. We talk about this with Dr. Ed a lot. Basically, if your AHI is not high, if you're mild to moderate sleep apnea, the mandibular advancement device is honestly, it's the way to go. It juts the jaw out. It takes a little while to get used to, but you're used to it. It basically opens the airways and it literally can be a lifesaver, especially for people that are CPAP intolerant. So if I were you, and if you want, come on Tuesday. I can give you some names depending on where you live. I'm a member of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. We have connections all over the country. I can refer you to a sleep doc in your area who can refer you to a dental provider who can actually implement, make, and then maintain one of these mandibular advancement devices. So do they work? Absolutely, positively. Long and frustrating journey. You're talking about standard CPAP responses. I mean, these things are not easy to wear. If you have really acute, severe apnea, AHIs 50 to 100, then CPAP is probably mandatory. But even then, there are other ways to manage it. But go talk to a sleep doc and then go see a dentist who makes these things. Okay, now we start to get some long ones here. Oh, here's a shorter one. Yeah, from Beryl, I'm not sure I can answer this one. In my interview with Pema Chodron, that was a couple of years ago, she mentioned a book by Adam Tripton. I haven't heard this interview in so long. I don't know an Adam Tripton, Bruce Lipton, maybe? Adam Tripton, that name does not ring a bell. About the pause in daily life. Yeah, the pause practice in Bardo awareness. I could not find it. If possible, could you let me know the author's name? I can't, not without listening to the talk again. I don't know an Adam Tripton, so it's probably not who she was mentioning. I'm not able to listen to this presentation. It could be part of the voice recording. Okay. I can't refer you to that. But basically, in the programs that I've done with Bob Thurman at Menla, we do this pause practice like all the time. It's this impulse control thing that I work with in all my Bardo teachings. Impulse control is birth control. Impulse control is working with Bardo practice in terms of putting the pause button between stimulus and response. So there's a lot of other people that talk about it tangentially, me included. I can't pull off without listening to the talk again, who Pema was talking about back then. So I'm so sorry. After 60 some interviews, I can't remember every little detail, but I don't think it's Adam Tripton. That name does not ring a bell. Sorry, I can't be more helpful. Okay, these get slightly longer, so hang with me. And then if there's a live one, we can mix this up with a live question just so it's not me just totally reading everything. Okay, from Joe. Hi, Andrew. My primary 30-year meditation practice Just self-inquiry, good for you. It's a fantastic meditation. And one-pointed awareness on the I am sense in the heart center. That's really nice. It sounds like an Advaita Vedanta practice. That's great. This meditation is often carried into sleep and leads to dream sleep yoga. Excellent. Frequently resulting in floating through walls and out of the dream scene with an accompanied high frequency state of bliss rapture. That's awesome. Isn't that beautiful? And one of the reasons it's bliss rapture is because in order to flow through walls, you have to do it in a subtle body. That's a blissful state because it's less reified. It's less solid. That's what brings about the high frequency bliss rapture. This is low frequency. Subtle body is high frequency. Very subtle body is super high frequency, infrared. Metaphorically, not literally. Occasionally, bodiless awareness will shoot up into the stars. I love this stuff, man. This is awesome. Bodiless awareness will shoot up into the stars at an exceedingly fast rate of acceleration. That sounds like a kundalini or even a kind of a Poe experience, which is really cool. Good for you. If the acceleration slows, a bright white orb will often come into the visual field. Totally. That can be due to a ton of different things. It can be an entopic vision. It could be a Togal vision. Hard to say exactly what's probably going on, but it's probably some version of what's called Togal. If attention is turned away from the celestial objects and mostly maintained in the heart center, good for you. That's what you want to do. Stay centered. The upward trajectory will continue until it comes to rest underneath a vast ceiling of deep blue plasma-like liquid. This is awesome, man. That sounds like one of my psychedelic trips. I'm not dissing it. This is awesome. I love hearing these kinds of things. I've had these in dark retreat. I've had these experiences numerous times. Good for you. While the rapture is intense and pleasurable, that's fine. But again, don't get attached. Don't get attached. There can be an accompanying feelings of disorientation. Yeah, because it's just unfamiliar. And constraint impenetrability. I'm not sure why. Oh, I would suspect the constraint impenetrability is a feeling that you're coming back, maybe? That's not clear to me. That can arise and prompt a downward cascade back into a dream scene or a waking up. Yes. So what you're experiencing here to me, before I go further with this, is that, yes, you're kind of blasting off or actually blasting in, whether this is an out-of-body experience or a really deep subtle and very subtle body experience. That's hard to say on one level. That doesn't really matter. But the accompanying disorientation is totally fine. But you realize, Joe, the only reason you feel that is because you're trying to understand the experience while it's happening. Don't do that. Just go for the ride. The disorientation only comes about when you're trying to reference it back to central headquarters. That's what makes it disorienting. So don't do that. Or if you find yourself disoriented, you will find yourself doing that. That's a consequence of the contraction onto self. There can be accompanying feelings of disorientation and constraint. Yes, that's what it feels like when you're coming back down. You feel like you're being trapped. But that's only because you haven't taken that openness and brought it into your form. So you're having a Dharmakaya level experience. And similar to the experience of the question earlier, yes, it's great to have these mind-opening, mind-blowing experiences, but that's not the point. Mathematically, using the Trikaya system, that's one-third of the point. You want to take that insight, that openness, and then bring it back into form. So then it doesn't feel like a constraint when you come down. So you don't see the difference and you have no preference between being embodied and being transcendent. As long as you have a preference and you have a sense of bliss and pleasure and constraint, there's a cosmological dualism taking place. And therefore, your waking experience is incomplete, right? You want to take your heaven, bring it back to earth, bring it back to form, bring it back to body. Then it won't feel like a constraint. It'll feel like a dream. This will feel like an illusory form. Do you have any thoughts about what this blue liquid ceiling might represent? Yes. Do you have any suggestions about how to navigate this experience from a yogic standpoint? Yeah, I think I just said that. Don't reference it. Stabilize it. It's helpful to understand what's happening. Maybe what I've said has been of some benefit. And then again, the great equanimity, the great bliss. Don't have a preference for one or the other. If you prefer one experience over the other, that's not the great equanimity. That's still referentiality taking place. You want to let go of that. This is important because otherwise people just hang out on the bliss and the rapture and they think that's spirituality. Well, very limited understanding of spirituality. Then what happens when your life falls apart? What happens when you're dying? What happens when, you know, it's just a crap show? Where's your spirituality then? And that's why I even hate the word spirituality these days. It's a horrible word. I mentioned this, I don't have time to unload on it. But the two biggest problems with spiritual path, you've heard me say this, the two biggest problems with the spiritual path, number one, use of the word spiritual. Number two, use of the word path. The two worst things that ever happened to the spiritual path is the word spiritual and path. I wish I could say more, but maybe we can discuss it later. The liquid ceiling thing, that's tricky to say with complete authority, but this is one way to look into this, Joe, is study phase two of the luminous Bardo-Dharma Ta, especially in phase two, there are four stages, explore stages two, three, and four, especially three and four. Because in that Bardo literature, they talk about these canopies of light, this liquid ceiling. And so you can also experience it. You don't have to wait till you die to experience this. This is part of these Togal visions, which is probably also a little bit of what you're having, the radiant display of the mind in this kind of liquid light form. So again, it's so hard to say, good Lord, who am I? I'm just making an educated guess. But that's what it sounds like to me. It sounds similar to stage three, four, luminous Bardo Dharma Ta, which is where you just have these light canopy things. So explore, let's see here, Luminous Emptiness by my dear friend Francesca Fremantle. There's 100 pages on the Luminous Bardo Dharma Ta. This book is a masterpiece. And she riffs about it. Sogyal Rinpoche, and I know people go, oh my God, don't ever mention his name again. Sorry, Tibetan Book of Living and Dying is a great book. His teachings on the Bardo Dharma Ta, he talks about this. Most people who do talk about Bardo Dharma Ta, especially the four phases, they will address this. Okay, really good. This is awesome. Very cool. Okay. All right, hang with me and then maybe I'll take a live one. Or if we don't have a live one, I'm just going to keep reading these. Okay, from Joni. Two-part question. I've been having recurring nightmares for the last couple of years where I'm lost cleaning up vast amounts of trash. Sorry. And on a drinking binge and in trouble. I've been sober for 6 years. Good for you. You might be interested in the talk I'm going to have with John on integral recovery, by the way. Or that the world is ending usually by water, fire or earth upheaval, swallowing everything, and oftentimes a combo of all. Okay. I feel like these have been communicating to me in waking life that I have work to do. We all have work to do. And it keeps leading me back to Buddhism. Okay. I have a boatload of wholesome fear. That's good. Wholesome fear means putting the fear of the truth of karma, the fear of the truth of dying. That's wholesome fear. You want that. That's good fear because it'll propel you. Oh, there's this beautiful line. This is worth tossing out from Milarepa. This guy killed 37 people. I'm sure he had a lot worse nightmares than you did. And in this beautiful verse from one of his songs, he said this, in horror of death, see, that's the wholesome fear. In horror of death, I took to the mountains, contemplating again and again on the uncertainty and the hour of death. I captured the fortress of the deathless, unending nature of mind. Now all fear of death is over and done with. What a great verse. Wholesome fear led him to retreat, led him to his awakening. I have a boatload of wholesome fear of dying without cleaning my karma warehouse or being lucid during my death transition. That's healthy fear. That's good. I have been lucid in a dream, which is very exciting, but it seems the more I try to become lucid, the more vivid these nightmares become, and it's frustrating that I can't get in there to clean them up. Okay. What do I do when I get in there to start transforming these nightmares into dreams that count as work towards the cleaning up of my karma in my sleep hours? What a great question. For waking hours, let me get that because then there's a waking hours thing. So here's the underlying thing. There's so many ways to work with nightmares. Again, I try to toss out references when I can. My dear friend, Claire Johnson wrote, I interviewed her on both on Nightclub and Edge of Mind. Her beautiful book, The Art of Transforming Nightmares, is really, really good. So there's two, there's nightmares occur across the spectrum, and there's a spectrum of ways to work with these. One way is through classic psychological approaches where you work with integration healing. And those are extraordinarily helpful, and lucid dreaming can be super profound and helpful along those lines as well. And Claire writes about this beautifully. But even deeper than this, because this is a deep set of questions connected to some of what I was talking about earlier, the most important thing is nightmare principle. Not just your nighttime nightmares. Your nighttime nightmares are just an epiphenomenal secondary expression of the nightmare principle altogether. That's what you want to work with. Because if you work with a nightmare principle, this is what this is the irreducible inner work. Everything, if you do this, tricky word these days, everything trumps. It's amazing how he's trashed the language, right? Can't even use that word anymore. Working with a nightmare principle trumps everything. And what the nightmare principle is reification, solidifying. So when you're in a nightmare, a classical nighttime nightmare, yes, it's scary because there's a monster there or whatever. Yes, it's scary because of everything you said. I'm not dismissing that. But what really makes it a nightmare is not that. It's taking that bloody thing to be real. Reification is the fundamental nightmare. That's nightmare principle. So when you work with nightmare principle, what's the fundamental solution? Emptiness. The teachings on illusory form, I wrote a whole bloody book on this. My book, Dreams of Light, is all about this. So this is the way to do this, both during the day and at night. You start working with this, you're really cleaning up your karma. There's nothing more powerful than cleaning up your karma than working with the teachings on emptiness and luminosity, nothing. On top of that, then you have all these secondary methods like dream yoga, meditation, therapy, all that. They're all great. But if you want to really get to the hard essence of it, study and practice the teachings on emptiness, formlessness, because that's what creates any nightmare. And then it doesn't matter what happens day or night. As long as you see the illusory nature of whatever arises, that's what it means to wake up, and that de-reification process will take care of any nightmares. Nightmares only exist when you reify things. So that I would go the hard essence here. Okay, for waking hours, I'm wondering if Buddhism is the path for me that would be the first steps. For example, is there a baseline book I can read? Yes, I'll give you a couple to start getting familiar with all the terms. Yes, there's so many. I hear you. Yeah. Can you recommend anything you could recommend to read if the mind is chasing many rabbits? Yeah, this is a classic Zen saying, chase two rabbits, catch none. And then how do I find a Sangha teacher? Okay, lots of questions here. Well, just to be brief, my dear friend Reggie Ray wrote two, I think, wonderful books, Indestructible Truth, which is a Hinayana Mahayana volume, really, really great. And then his really beautiful Secrets of the Vajra World, which is on Tantra Vajrayana. I like it because it's encyclopedic, but it's written by a practitioner, not just a scholar. He's a PhD, University of Chicago scholar, deep practitioner. And these books, I've read them a number of times. They're among the best foundational texts. There are so many others, but if you want something reference-wise that joins academic and practice modalities, I think Reggie's work is really helpful here. In terms of finding a sangha and a teacher, that's difficult. You know, that's so idiosyncratic. I can tell you my favorites. You know, Theragar, Sugyen Rinpoche's organization is unbelievable. Polnup Rinpoche's Natartha is off the charts. I mean, there's so many. Secret Culture Rinpoche. You know, the way you find a teacher and a sangha is you just, first of all, you hold that question deep in your heart. You really mean it. And then there is something to be said about, you know, the teacher will appear. And then you have to test the teacher, right? Don't just sign on the dotted line, test them. Test the sangha, test the teacher, ask the hard questions, kick the tires, look underneath the hood. Because these days, you know, if you haven't been reading the literature, it's really easy to get burned. So that's a really, really big topic that maybe we can address at a later point because there's just so much to say here. But I would just say, be critical. If they don't address the hard questions, they're not for you. If they don't want you to challenge them, they're not for you. You want a community that is willing to be questioned to a certain point. I mean, it's some, that can get a little bit excessive, but I think you get the idea. So yeah, maybe something like that. Okay, I don't want to get too speedy here.
We have some live ones too.
Yeah, I see those. Let me just do... I think I got all these before I get to the two quite big ones in terms of length. So I have to switch to a different doc to do that. So in the meantime, I will get Glenn, Kimberly, and then I'll come back to the longer ones that were sent in. Okay, Glenn, fire away, buddy.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, bud.
Good to see you. A question. A long time ago when I was in college, I think this was back in the 60s or 70s, there was an understanding that the human skin was somewhat of the same nature of the retina. So work was being done on people who were blind having things that they could feel and they could see.
It's called mind sight. Yep.
And I've kind of wondered, so sitting in various times and having an itch. So I scratch the itch. If I scratch the itch, I notice, oh, look, it's reappearing in another place, right? And I realized, I came to a possible insight, I don't know if it's true, that an itch is actually a thought, because it's operating on in the same brain mechanism. And a lot of itches you can never find. So you get an itch here and you look for it, it's not there, it's actually in another place, it's somewhere else. And I'm just thinking, so the mind has thoughts, all these other things, and an itch is one of them. And I've noticed now, if I just ignore it, or don't ignore it, it's there, it's present, and it goes away like a thought. It comes, it goes. So I'm just wondering if I'm approaching that the right way.
Yes, I think you can. In fact, there's a really, I can't remember the title of it. A really interesting article came out about, I don't know, 8-9 years ago, on, I think it was New Yorker, about, just to show you how wild this can get, about this gal who had this insatiable, irresolvable itch.
Hmm.
And she got to the point, this is no exaggeration, when you read the article, you're going, oh, Lordy. She actually got to the point where she scratched herself down to her bone, right? Literally, not metaphorically. She had worn off all her skin and she was like scratching her bone or something like really dramatic like that. So that certainly lends credibility on an extreme level to your assertion, which I think has provisional validity in that, yes, what we classify as an itch and our desire to resolve it through scratching on one level is a thought construct. But yet on another level, we do have itches that you could say prior, you know, it's called primary data, right? Before you label it as an itch, there is some undeniable neurophysiological thing happening in your system. And, you know, you can append the label itch to it, but that I don't think you can dismiss. I think this is where you have to centrifuge out the phenomenal versus the relational realities, that there is something there that is not dependent on your interpretation, that you wouldn't label an itch. They can be measured. They can be, that's the relational reality. And then there's phenomenal reality. That's what you do with it. That's what you label itch. That's what you scratch. That's what creates this kind of secondary propontia proliferation that takes takes place on top of that primary data. And so I'm not sure what else to say about that outside of, yes, really interesting. Anything else you want to add, Glenn? Or...
No, that's it. Thank you.
Yeah, check it out. I wish I remember the name. But it's a really interesting article that then went to talk about, I remember it clearly because it had a really interesting couple pages on how it is that we basically construct our realities in a pretty rigorous kind of philosophical scientific sense. Mm-hmm. But it's in the New Yorker, if you Google something, I don't know how you could find it, but it's worth looking. It's worth looking for. It's a pretty cool piece. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Kimberly, fire away, dear, and then I'll get these two longer ones, and then I'll see if there's anything in the chat.
Hi.
Hello. I'm good. How are you?
So my question is about the subtle body.
Okay.
Oh, thank you. I think we're in a bit of a time lapse. So my question is about the subtle body, and is it that we actually create it, or it's already like there and we're just like kind of moving our consciousness towards it, which highlights it?
Good question. Yeah, subtle body is another one of these multivalent terms, which means it has a number of different definitions based on context. The way I roll with this is that subtle body has both a phenomenal or phenomenological aspect and a physiological aspect. They're connected, but they're not quite the same. And so the physiological aspect is the easiest one. Well, actually, they're both pretty easy to wrap our minds around. The subtle body is what many of the Eastern traditions, especially Hindu, Buddhist, Tantra, you know, talk about and describe in voluminous detail. There are medical texts associated with this. There's a massive meditation text, literally a third, at least according to my friend Reggie Ray in his book, Secrets of the Vajra World, a third of all Vajrayana tantric practice is devoted to inner yogas. The inner yogas are associated with subtle body. So that's the physiological subtle body that's made of tsalung tigle, you know, the winds, the drops, the wheels, the chakras, and that whole thing. So that's the phenomenal, that's the physiological subtle body. Then you have the phenomenological subtle body. And that's your thoughts and your emotions and basically aspects of your experience that are not basically exclusively associated with reified physical form. See? And so therefore, I think it's helpful to centrifuge those two things out. They're definitely connected, especially in the world of dream yoga, because dream yoga works with the subtle physiological body. That's why we do the throat visualization. We do the breath thing. We do all that inner yogic stuff to work the physiological subtle body as a way to bring about phenomenological subtle body experiences called dreams, right? And so therefore, I think it's helpful to understand those two renderings of subtle body. And I'll pause there to see if that's helpful or if you want to take this somewhere else.
So then, you know, within Didi yoga, when we, you know, creating or imagining the Didi, and I suppose the goal, you tell me, is to become the deity. Does that mean we kind of like creating our subtle body or manipulating our subtle body to be in the form of the deity and taking on the characteristics?
Yes, exactly. So when you're working, the purified subtle body, you could say is provisionally, you could say the purified subtle body is the deity. But again, here, don't reify the deity. It's deity principle. Deity principle here is exactly connected to the nightmare principle. To deify is to elusify. To reify is to impure, right? Impurify. These are my language, right? So instead of reifying, deify. That's what deity practice is. Deity practice replaces reification with deification. Basically, that's what you're doing. And you're doing it through subtle body processes. You're working with visualizing your body in these pure forms with clear limpid channels. You're basically using the principles of what I call nadi plasticity, right? The channels. You're using the power of breath work and visualization and mantra recitation to literally shape shift and yogic exercise to shape shift the physiology and anatomy of the subtle body. And so then that becomes, well, that's purified, that's recognized as the deity. But you can achieve the deity in a number of different ways. That's a little bit more bottom up using subtle body processes. You can also do a top down with purely so-called mental practices. But the great gift of the Tantra tradition is the bidirectionality. You can use both. See? So, but basically, yeah, the deity yoga works. It's like a transitional practice, transitional object. It helps you transition away from reified form into fully de-reified empty form. It's also the exercise of the Sambhogakaya. So when you talk about subtle body, you're talking about Sambhogakaya level practices. So again, this is, you know, once you start kind of equating it with that, then you have a vast array of different skillful sets in addition to deity yoga. Like, in fact, even Pure Land practice, I heard Tana Rinpoche say something very, very interesting, which I hadn't heard before in a recent program I attended, where he said Pure Land practice is what's called Sambhogakaya Poa. I never heard that before. And that's basically a subtle body thing, but that's a different story. So is that helpful?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's basically like once you have a good handle on the subtle body, I think the kind of transferring the consciousness, the aware consciousness into that body of then goes on to, I think, the poa. Is that right?
It depends on what type of poa you're talking about. There are at least five types of tantric poa and then various levels of sutra poa.
Okay.
Most people, when they talk about poa, they're talking about...
So I'm good at it.
When most people talk about poa, they're talking about nirmanakaya poa, which is a subtle body ejection through the central channel, that hiccuping practice. So that's nirmanakaya poa.
But that's what I was talking about.
Yeah, there are other types of practices. And the other thing about the transference here, you know, here's one, perhaps a healthier way to look at it, is that these subtle bodies, the subtle body and the very subtle body, these are things that don't really have to be generated. They're provisionally generated as generation stage practice. That's a relative skillful means. Fundamentally, to really acknowledge, recognize the subtle body, it's really, in fact, just that. It's an act of recognition. It's already there. And the practice is really transferring our sense of identity, somewhat connected earlier to the earlier question about all these, you know, galactic experiences. Part of the practice is to transfer our identity from exclusive identification with nirmanakaya, outer form, transitioning it into the subtle body processes. That's where all mantra comes in, visualization, general stage practice, deity yoga, a huge array of what are called inner court practices. They come in there. And then you have the other third of all the tantric practices. Then you have the very subtle formless body meditations. So the key is to exercise, develop familiarity with all three, the trikaya. And you can do that provisionally through all these methods, but you can also do it in more fruitional, ultimate aspects by just recognizing these, tuning into them, and then basically opening, expanding our sense of identity to include all these three dimensions of our body-mind matrix.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so two quick things.
Yeah, go ahead.
So that would be kind of just, is it just a path or a tool to lead one to see the clear light mind in that sense, the fluidity of one's own self to become so many, to become like the subtle body, but then that kind of opens the door that if I can become this, then you can kind of become anything.
That's correct.
Any persona, any personality.
That's well said. That's absolutely correct. So the ultimate goal of all the practices are the clear light practices. That's another way to talk about emptiness. That's the essence of the whole shebang. So fundamentally, when you recognize that, it's the steepest path, but that's fundamentally all you need to do. But it is a bit steep. And so therefore, we have all these more relative approaches of doing it. But once you actualize, recognize emptiness, clear light mind, again, that trumps everything. You get that, then everything else automatically just, you realize, what do they say? All dharmas agree at one point. You know, the 84,000 dharmas, all the teachings fundamentally circumambulate this empty core, so to speak. So yes, on one level, that's absolutely the way to look at it. And I'm not sure what else to say at this point.
Okay, cool. And then the last thing is, do you have any recommendations for, like you're talking about all the dharmakayas and the bardos and subtle bodies? I think you recommended the luminous emptiness. Is there any other books, or is that kind of the good book to go for info on all that?
And be specific about what that is again. Just say that again.
Bardo yoga, I suppose, generating the subtle body and the dharmakayas.
No, they're different. No, I mean, yeah. Francesca's is really fantastic because half the book is preparation material for the book. And so she goes through the whole, this really brilliant chapter on the three levels of reality that is all set around the trikaya principle. It's more explanatory. It doesn't really tell you about the practices. You know, other books that I might recommend, I mentioned this last week, I have it up because I'm rereading it. This is a must read. Creation and Completion, The Essential Points of Tantric Meditation. This, you have to read this book.
Yeah, that looks awesome.
Because the essential points of creation and completion is it's basically what we're talking about here. Creation stage practice is generation stage practice. That's what works with subtle body. So I think Francesca's book and that would be really, really solid starts. But the literature is colossal. There's so much out there. And also Reggie's book, Secrets of the Modular World, that's really great because it gives you a very clear survey of where the practices are, where the teachings fit in, all that kind of thing. So as a reference text, I think that's a really good one. But if you don't have the creation completion text, that's highly recommended as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah, welcome. Okay, so I have a couple of these slightly longer ones. I hope I'm not racing through these, but I try to get through them and there's a fair amount here. So, okay. I listened to my podcast with Michael Taft. He's a good friend. Hoping I can answer a few questions. Okay, I'll try. I have a regular meditation practice. Good for you. Free form in nature. That's okay, but be careful and make sure not too freestyle, because otherwise you can fool yourself. I usually sit for at least half an hour, if not hour. And I suppose it's a version of a formless practice. Okay. I have to ask you more to see if that's the case. I do begin with breath, move on to somatic scanning. Very nice. And then try and dwell in stillness while being mindful of not falling into a stupor. Beautiful. There are several things I notice and regularly experience during meditation. I wonder what about them. One, when dwelling in stillness, once I'm there, there's a phenomenon where I believe the mind as ego subtly becomes the moment. Okay, I don't understand that. The ego subtly becomes the moment. I literally just don't know what that means. So if you're here and want to clarify that for me, that'd be great. It is almost a sort of trick of the mind and adaptive behavior of mimicking stillness. This is the best way I can think of describing this phenomenon. Yeah, I can't wrap my mind around that one. The languaging just doesn't click for me. So I'll slide in the event that you're here and you want to come on and clarify it. I read this earlier. These latter two do make sense to me. Another phenomena is when I've managed to become quite still. If there is some noise in the room, for instance, the house is creaking. If it's at night, I experience a sort of contraction. Yes, absolutely. Because the contraction is basically everything that happens, especially when instances of reactivity. I experience a sense of contraction, a sort of contraction of my senses, almost like you were to touch a sea anemone, for instance, and it recoils from your touch. What a lovely analogy or image. The experience is noticeable as a visual disturbance, but the experience as a whole body contraction is a whole body contraction has a sort of bell ringing quality to it. Yeah, I'm not sure about the bell ringing. That's somewhat idiosyncratic. But the whole body contraction thing, whoa, this is a big deal. And this is something that's definitely worth exploring. In fact, those of you who know my stuff, my next two books talk a lot about this contraction thing. It's a big deal. Let me see if there's anything I can say about that. The fact that you're touching into these contractions is really, really good. And in fact, the more you open with meditations, the more that creates a contrast medium, the more you'll be able to sensitize yourself and the more you'll notice these contractions. And that's actually really good. It's a little bit painful because it's so revelatory, but it's also really highly prescriptive. It'll allow you to identify these cascades of contractions and then gradually open, relax, and release them. Excuse me. The other thing I was interested in your perspective is I find my eyes will constantly open. I'm sorry, my eyes will spontaneously open and I'll awaken after having sitting for a bit. Okay. The phenomenon is quite automatic in nature and led me to explore just watching the body during meditation in the way it is very subtly, very active without my input. That's a really wonderful thing to do. This is a really interesting thing to point out, even like right here, right now. So here you go. Until I bring my attention to the blinking of your eyelids, you're unconscious of the fact that you're blinking all the time. It's there, it's obfuscated consciousness, right? Until I bring your attention to the fact that you're breathing, you probably don't even know that that particular aspect of your experience is taking place. And so with these types of interoceptive explorations, you can start to become increasingly more aware of these marvelous things that are happening within your body all the time, up to a certain point. Because it's like my friend Bernardo Kastrup says, and this is an amazing statement, and this has been mathematically, allegedly, I haven't really looked at the papers, the work of Carl Friston. Apparently, mathematically, and I haven't read it, so I can't say for sure, he suggested very compellingly that if we were to somehow perceive reality as it really is, without the filters of our perceptual and somatic apparatus, we would turn into an entropic soup. We would just basically melt on the spot, right? I actually think this is what happens when we die. I think this is what actually constitutes the death process. You open to such a degree, you actually do dissolve into entropic soup. So I really like what you're saying here, because this invites a very sensitive interoceptive exploration, where you can become sensitive to, like what Kimberly was talking about, the workings not only of the subtle dimensions of your physical body, but even deeper, the subtle dimensions of your very subtle body, which is below even that. So anything that's going to bring you in, anything that's going to send you into the center of yourself is a beautiful thing to do, whether it's yoga, meditation, this type of inner vipassana, fantastic. This is hard and has taken some time, as I have a very hard time just letting the body be and not driving it. Boy, there is a revelatory, honest statement, isn't it true? Very hard time just letting the body be and not driving it. Well, this is why we get sick, because we do drive it and we drive it off course. And so to whatever extent we can just let the body be. I mean, this is what sleep forces. Sleep forces us to just let the body be. And this is why if you don't sleep, you die. Not metaphorically, you literally die. So nature forces us into sleep to let the body just be. Stop driving it, because if we continue to drive it, we're going to drive it into the gutter and we're going to kill ourselves, and we do it. So whatever we can do, this is so lovely what you're saying here, whatever you can do to just be with your body really sensitively, the deeper you go, the more you're going to discover, the more you're going to realize that the body doesn't need to be driven. The body will naturally drive and coast itself. So this is really lovely. For instance, when observing my breath, which often induces a sort of anxiety. So anyway, if you're here listening and want to say something about this first thing about mind becoming subtly the moment, I can try to address that. I literally just don't understand it. Sorry. Okay.
I've got him. Let me get him unmuted real quick.
Oh, cool. Excellent. Always the best.
Okay, it should be good to go now, I think.
Yeah, feel far away.
Uh-oh, he said he has to restart his Zoom. Audio is not working.
Okay, well, let him restart it and then he can come back on and we can call on him, okay? Cool. Yeah, it's always best when I can have some interchange. Okay, here's another one. Yeah, these are great. These are just great. Sorry, they're a little bit long. I was taken from my mother as a baby, and things didn't get better after that until I was on my own. All the trauma led to night terrors at a very young age. To escape them, I taught myself to lucid dream, and I also started to astral travel. Good for you. I mean, not good for you for having that experience, but good for you to teach yourself lucid dreaming. After doing this for a few years, I started to question my waking state versus my dream state. I definitely know what you're talking about. Read my introduction to my book, Dream Yoga, where I had share a 4-page story where I almost thought I was going to lose my mind because I couldn't tell the difference between waking and dreaming reality. This was a long time ago. I started to question my waking dream state, at times not being sure which was which. Yep, I know exactly what that's like. And that's when things really got interesting. I can totally relate to that. I am an indigenous descent and was sent to live with pretty strict religious people that look down on all this as witchcraft. Yes, because it scares them. It doesn't fit the conventional mode, so they freak out. Everybody does that, closed-minded people. So the trick is, this is again, it's very easy for me and others to look and say, oh, they're so closed-minded. I always pause and say, okay, where am I closed-minded? What are my blind spots? What am I not seeing? So I don't want to be hubristic and say, they're closed-minded. We're all closed-minded. Until you're a Buddha, you're closed-minded. It just depends on the degree of the closures and your awareness of it or not. I'm absolutely closed-minded in ways I don't even know yet, but at least I'm trying. Okay, so when I picked a truck tire up with one finger, that's awesome. That's really cool. Let's just say none of this was ever encouraged. I have to giggle here because it's so true. It's hysterical in a sad way. And I was ostracized, yes, because you didn't fit the mold. You're a pariah because you make people uncomfortable. You're a liminal being because you're not fitting the standard mode. And, you know, the issue is not with you. The issue is with them. I was ostracized and it caused a great deal of trouble. I bet it did. I'm so sorry you had to go through it, especially at a young age. That's when it's really, really hard. So I started to suppress it. Yeah, classic. And I thought it was just probably going crazy and that what I was doing would be dangerous. No, it's not dangerous. It's just dangerous in that set and setting. And the fact that you thought you're going crazy, again, is totally normal, given the kind of constrained environment in which you share this story. So my heart goes out to you. This is really, it's sad. But at least you're identifying it, and it looks like you're at least working with it, which is beautiful. In my adulthood, I've had a few other reality-bending experiences. Yes, let me say this. I think this is from Jeffrey Kapal. The weirder something is, the truer it is. Let me say that again. The weirder something is, the truer it is. And I'm not sure if Jeffrey said this or Sean, my friend. Anomalous experiences are intimations of non-duality. Let me say that one again. Anomalous experiences are intimations of non-duality. So what we do is out of fear, we filter out, and there's the data here is like, we take in less than 1/10 trillionth of what's happening around us. And that tiny little sliver that gets through all our crazy filters, that basically gets through to support the continuing ridiculous way we have of looking at the world. This is all part of this crazy, ridiculous contraction thing. And so basically, let me just continue here. In my adulthood, I've had a few other reality-bending experiences. Yes, celebrate them. You're not going crazy. Everybody else is crazy. You're dropping into reality. They tend to happen either when I'm in deep meditation, beautiful, I'm not sure something has happened till it is confirmed by another. Or I'm daydreaming about doing something and then I am told that at the time I was seen doing that thing I was daydreaming about. Okay, that's cool. In honesty, I don't know how many times I do or have done these things, except for the times have been confirmed by other people. I mean, does it matter? Does it need to be confirmed by other people? I mean, in terms of understanding it, so you don't think you're literally going clinically crazy. And by the way, parenthetically, that only takes place when you lose metacognition. When you lose the capacity to reflect upon what you're experiencing, and what does that mean? You start to reify the experience. So that's the only time it ever becomes problematic. If your heart is open and big enough, your worldview is big enough, this kind of shamanistic liminal being stuff, that's just starts to be your beautiful, wonderful, rich, magical world. It's delightful. You should celebrate it. And don't worry about these other people. I think it was James, what's his name? The sociologist, Coleman. James Coleman writes about how it is that, I wish I had the quote, how it is that when you challenge other people's dreams, you're going to be in trouble, right? In other words, when you challenge other people's realities, you're a liminal being, you don't fit in. LGBTQ, and then the new one, the Tulpas. I mean, these people, these wonderful beings that just don't fit into conventional modes are really unsettling for people. Trungpa Rinpoche was like this. And so you are a very gifted, open, beautiful, receptive soul that's had these amazing experiences. Take refuge in your experiences. Easier said than done. Don't let yourself be constrained. Again, not easy to do. Realize you're not weird. The weirder your experience, the truer it is. I mean, within limits, right? And again, that goes overboard when you lose metacognitive capacities. That's psychosis. I don't see anything like that here. You're just a really intuitive, empath, psychic kind of person. This too has led me to feeling a little bit crazy. Crazy is all a matter of degree. Who's crazy? You're not crazy. The other people are crazy. But now I know about dream yoga. I know this is real and not just all in my head. Absolutely. I have no idea what to do and where to start. Well, start by taking refuge in your own experience, in your own heart. Strengthen it perhaps by exploring some of these traditions that work with this, not just Buddhist or Hindu, but the shamanistic traditions. Read the work of Melodoma Somme. Read the work of Carlos Castaneda. Read the work of these alternative fringe thinkers, experiencers, and realize, you know, this is par for the course. Once you start to open the aperture of your awareness, you start to perceive reality without filters. Celebrate it. So relationship to these issues is like the meditation experiences I was talking about earlier. There's nothing at all problematic with any of what you're sharing here. None. The issue is relationship. Your relationship to yourself, your relationship to the experience, and also the way others, right? But this is where the real inner work becomes a warrior practice, warriorship, where it takes real courage to be true to yourself, to speak and live your truth. And you'll have casualties. You'll lose friends, quote unquote. You'll lose people who are really not into you challenging their worldview. You make them uncomfortable. Trust me, my life has been radically simplified as these friends just drop away. They don't want to be challenged, and you're challenging them just by the way you're living your life. I'm the closest lead to someone that knows what I'm talking about. Oh, there's many others, but I'm glad that I can maybe say a few things. Any suggestion of information I would greatly appreciate. Read the work of Jeffrey Kapal. Listen to the talk I did, the first of two, I just did the first one. Listen to the interview I did with Sean Esbjorn Hargens on exo-studies and read that paper. The bottom of that link on Edge of Mind, we have a paper. I posted the paper. I think it's called The Wild Cosmos with a K. Read that paper. And the more you have that kind of larger exo view, big open view, the more you realize, whoa, I'm not the nutcase here. The closed-minded people are the nutcases, right? Yeah, so explore Sean's work. He's writing 2 or 3 books on that this year. He's a good friend. My last experiences happened in the last 4 years, and despite my stopping my intentional practice around astral traveling and lucid dreaming as a kid, my abilities have grown. Oh, that makes me happy. Good for you. I teleported and walked through a wall as an adult. Oh, high five. That's awesome. I no longer fear what people around me think. Yes. And now I see this as a gift. Yes. But a gift I cannot properly use without the foundational teachings and practices. This is beautiful. This is just brilliant. Yes, sometimes what happens here is this is wonderful kind of tripartite approach in Buddhism of understanding, experience, realization. We've talked earlier about experience and realization. I'm going to say now a word about retrofitting everything with understanding. And what you're saying here is so spot on. That we can have, and I speak from personal experience, we all can have experiences. They're not realizations because they're not stable. We can absolutely have experiences prematurely in the sense that you don't have the understanding. You don't have the infrastructure to understand what the heck just happened to me, what is actually going on. And that's where things can also become somewhat problematic because, again, you reify the experience, you don't know what's happening. That can become a bit of an issue. So what you're doing here is beautiful. You've had experiences, and now what you're saying is spot on. Retrofit the experience with understanding, and then you realize these experiences are totally normal. They're actually intimations of real growth and development. So maybe what I say can be of some benefit. Maybe some of the people I reference can be of some benefit, but thank you for sharing this. It's really beautiful. I love it. Okay. And if you're here and you want to come on and say something more, that's great. But if we have Phil, if he's here, are you clear, bud? Did we get him?
I think so.
And I think I have one more.
I think I'm unmuted.
Hey, bud.
Hey, thanks for taking the question.
Totally.
I don't know if I might have sort of moved past this question that I asked you. It's sort of an old question I've had. It's something I've puzzled on for a while. Maybe it's confusing, but it's really like when you're sitting, when I'm sitting, meditating. There's that point where, like, if you fall asleep, it's like you realize you've stopped being present. And at some point, it's kind of like the mind takes over, like thoughts begin infilling, you start identifying with the thoughts and you're gone. It's like this mimicking behavior. And I mean, I can think of kind of answered my own question just by remaining present beyond that and watching kind of how that process happens. But nice. I mean, it's really fast and subtle. And so I think that just going deeper and deeper, then that edge kind of slows down, if that makes sense. But that's what it is, sort of the process of them being reconsumed by the identified reality. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. If I'm tracking you, I think so. Yes. What I might recommend, if I'm hearing you properly, Phil, is especially when you're dropping into these kind of liminal spaces, you know, you're in meditation and you're starting to get really quiet, if I heard you properly, and then maybe you're starting to even doze off. This is where you can bring liminal dreaming into play and work with cultivating a witness awareness, which is a little bit like you were saying, I can't remember the exact languaging you were talking about, where you basically retreat in the best sense of the word to dispassionately bear witness to the display. And therefore it doesn't matter what the display is. It's a little bit like the earlier thing about experiences. It really doesn't matter. The issue right. is one of relationship to that display. And so if you can retreat to a truer dimension of your being that is not so easily swept up and lost in the display, which is what defines non-lucidity and samsara in general, then on a very real level, that from that indestructible witnessing point, it doesn't matter what happens. And so on one level, you could say that is the point. But the quick thing to say is that this doesn't then therefore, you know, this is off when there becomes the witnessing space. Instead of differentiating, it becomes dissociative, right? So that's the near enemy of differentiation is dissociation. And then from that dissociated state, then you have inappropriate relationships to the arising. From the differentiated state, you have a really equanimous relationship to what arises. It just doesn't matter. So that's what comes to mind. Does that seem to resonate with you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, part of the issue is that it's a question I'm not even sure I know how to ask, or if I'm even perceiving this thing quite the right way. I mean, the other thing I'm thinking about when you talk about it is just, and I get this part, is like the clinging, grasping nature of mind, or this reflexive clinging and grasping, which causes you to, I mean, this, on the one sense, this is like a necessary egotistic function to operate into the world, to like hold on to stuff. The antidote for realization is seeing that process and then learning how to relax, expand when necessary. So, I mean, it's like, and so I think that's part of,
Yeah. I mean, I think you got it right. And so, yes, we do need on a provisional level to have this particular form of development that we know as the ego. The ego is not the problem. Ego is just a form of development. It becomes problematic when it becomes an arrested form of development. And it becomes arrested when we what? We identify exclusively with form. So the whole notion is transcend but include the ego. You seem to suggest that. We need this developmental sense in order to relate to others. Our body needs to function by separating out self or other. Otherwise, our immune systems wouldn't work. So that type of development is absolutely critical. And so therefore, when people that start trashing the ego, I mean, that's not a very helpful thing to do, because it's like saying, I'm going to trash age 4. No, you don't do that. You transcend but include it. Ego has a place. Just don't let it dominate. So, I mean, I don't hear anything that, I don't know, sounds of any concern per se. I mean, it seems pretty darn healthy to me from what I'm hearing.
Sure. And like I said, I formed the question and you answered it. I was like, God, maybe that's not exactly the question, but it was useful anyway to get the discussion going. And yeah, actually, I don't know. But go ahead. What were you going to say?
No, please finish.
Well, and actually, something else you're going to say, it slightly switches the subject, that you were talking about the person you were talking about who says that if we were actually to experience everything possible all at once, we would just sort of melt.
Yeah.
And I've always thought the importance of Buddhism is one of the things that's critical is that with death, that for the unprepared mind, you basically, it is disillusionment, you're gone. For the prepared mind, you can transit this and then have the possibility of coming back in a form that's sort of
absolutely
whole.
That's it.
Or
that's
more whole.
Totally. Because there's a voluntary whole, because then you're coming back voluntarily. This reminds me, if you haven't seen the movie yet, Everything Everywhere All at Once, it's nominated for Best Academy Award. Check this thing out, man.
I watched part of it, and it was 25 minutes of it was enough to digest.
It's hysterical, right? This is a classic illusory form Bardo film. It's just insane.
Yeah.
And so some of it happens so fast and it's so effing funny. So when you said, yeah, when we talked about everything, experience everything all at once, you can dissolve. Well, watch this film, Everything Everywhere All at Once. It's just a riot. At least I thought it was.
Classic. So anyway,
something like that comes to mind. But yeah, thanks for sharing, Phil. I appreciate it, man.
Yeah, and thanks for your time. This is really great. It's totally unexpected. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Absolutely. So Prem Das, and then there are two other questions that came in, but these are really long, and they just came in buzzer shots. So I'm going to get those next time. I'll put them front and center. A really nice one about Pure Lands and Pure Land experiences, but this is like a page and a half that I have to digest, summarize, and then respond to. So Prem, we'll go with you, and then I try to clip this up around an hour and a half mark anyway. So fire away, my friend.
Yes, sir, Andrew. I had a question about perception and, within the Sambhogakaya, because I'm kind of fixated on these 18 dhatus and the ayatanas and, the sensory organs and mind. So I'm like, that framework, can that framework be adapted?
That framework is transcended.
Okay, so the sense organs do not participate in the perception in the Sambhogakaya.
Not in the normal way. No, the sense organs are actually transcended. So this is part of the, what's it called? Pratyadhara, I think it's called, the withdrawal phase, right? Mm-hmm. The senses are actually transformed. And the dhatus, and the ayatanas and all those really brilliant, wonderful Abhidharma descriptions, they're transcended. And so you literally start to perceive in new ways. You start to, all the sense faculties are actually transcended. And so again, you transcend, but include the ayatanas and the dhatus and the skandhas and all that kind of stuff, but they don't function in the way. So that particular heuristic has to be left behind, which is exactly why you go from Hidayana to Mahayana to Vajrayana. So this is more, not a criticism. This is more a Theravada Hidayana description. It's fantastically powerful. Mm-hmm. Because what does it do? It starts to atomize. It starts to de-automatize the reified self-sense. Let me share this with you, Prem Das. This was a really interesting thing for me. I don't know, 30 years ago, I was attending, I think it might've been the first Natartha Institute, month-long training, and Sopa Choling, and it started off with 2 weeks of Trungpa Rinpoche and then 2 weeks with Pulam Rinpoche. It was a fantastic month. And I remember very clearly, Trungpa Rinpoche was in for the first 2 weeks. And there was all this stuff, we were talking about all the stuff about mind and its functions and the Abhidharma and all these lists and the dhatus and the yatanas and the skandhas. I mean, the stuff is like endless. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And he said something that was really kind of, I wouldn't say he got irritated, but it was very interesting. And again, this is my projection, but he kind of went like this after like the 15th question. He said, it's all the same. And then it's like, what is he talking about? It's all the same. And now I realized what he was getting at, because the skandhas, dhatus, ayatanas, it's all the same. And it's like, what? And I think 30 years later, I think what he was saying is they're all the same in the sense that each one of these skillful means is a way to de-automatize, deconstruct the reified self-sense. And so therefore, that's why you got 12 of these and 18 of that and whatever. I mean, these 52 of that. And I mean, it's like unbelievable. Read an Abhidharma text. That's like, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And so I think if you understand that fundamental narrative behind that, then you realize, oh, this is just a way to divide and conquer, to take the, it's basically an atomistic approach. The Abhidharma literally deals with the atoms of experience. And in that regard, to me, all of a sudden something really clicked. It was like, oh, no, that really makes sense to me. You know, that this is composed of that, all these numbers. On one level, when he says it's all the same, I think that's what he's talking about, which really makes sense to me. They're very powerful ways to get in there and to deconstruct, to deautomatize all these mechanisms that basically otherwise contract to create this crap show of self and other called duality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the particulars around that, how do the ayatanas and the dhatus, because as you know, they don't talk so much about the dhatus and the ayatanas, but Trungpa, let me take that back. He did talk about them as something like purified ayatanas, where basically two books that I recommend for you, Glimpses of Abhidharma, which is a tantric view of the Abhidharma. It's a masterpiece. And also his book, Shambhala, Sacred Path of the Warrior. He has some really interesting things. Oh, he called them limitless ayatanas. That's what he did. He talks about limitless ayatanas, which is when these sense gates, when you open to that extent, they become infinite. And he talks about these forms of supernatural perception. But then when you enter that, that particular heuristic is left behind. Yeah, you can talk about the purified skandhas as the five Buddhas and that sort of thing. That's all great. But when you go to Mahayana and Vajrayana, it in a real way, it transcends this atomistic approach.
In the Yogacara paradigm, the first five vijnanas, first five consciousnesses, when they become the all-encompassing wisdoms, that's another way of
all accomplishing.
Okay, yeah. That's the same thing that you're getting at, I think. Or is it?
Yes. Yes, on one level. Yes. And that's what makes Yogacara so bloody brilliant. It's a bridge between Mahayana and Vajrayana. Mm-hmm. So it's a classic, it's such a powerful teaching tool that starts with the eight consciousnesses, right? And then each one of those, as you know, has their own sub-dharmas. And then what it does when those, purified and alleviated, I should say, removed in that sense, they're transformed. Mm-hmm. The consciousness are transformed into the wisdoms. And that actual moment of transformation is exactly the moment from Hinayana Mahayana to Tantra, see? And that's why the Yogacara is so bloody brilliant, because in a real way it acts, especially Majjhimaka Yogacara, right? You join those two together, that is the brilliant transition between the causal vehicles and the fruitional vehicle. And that's why studying the Yogacara from that perspective is really helpful.
Super. Thank you, sir.
Okay. All right, everybody. So there were a couple more that came in, but they came a little bit late and they were really long. I'll get to them next week, I promise. And there was also another one. I'm trying to find it because some of these don't come in through the usual. Give me 1 second. They don't come in through the usual thing. And sometimes, let me see if I can find it real quick. If not, I'll pull it up next time, I promise. Ah, I'm not finding it. Bummer. Okay. All right. Oh, sorry. Crash bang. 3:29, time to go. Thanks, everybody. Remember, we dedicate our merit. Anything we've done of value, we don't keep it for ourselves. Bring it all together, spread it out across the world so we don't hoard the stuff. Remember, the only way to hold on to anything is to let it go. Dedicate the merit for the benefit of all sentient beings. See you around. I'll be back in 2 weeks. Otherwise, stay healthy, stay safe. Thanks for your great questions. I hope I don't speed through these too quickly, but there's a lot to get through and sometimes I talk quickly. So bye-bye, everybody. If you want to unmute yourself and turn your mic, we do this little group hug thing. It's always kind of sweet. And until next time, ciao, ciao.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye. Sam.